Okay, I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak, and this is work in collaboration with Rodolfo, who is down there. Okay, so this is the plan of the talk. I'll do an introduction to this, and then I'll talk a little bit about spherical symmetric gravity. We're going to see that things actually complicate a little bit, so I'll have to talk about the problem of dynamics in canonical gravity and some alternative proposals to deal with it. Then I'll talk about how to do a loop representation of spherical symmetry and how to quantize a simplified version of spherical symmetry using Dirac quantizations. And I'll close with some expectations of what this could suggest for more general models. So let me start with an introduction and apologies. Of course, spherical symmetric spacetimes include the Schwarzschild spacetime and therefore the singularity, so there's some connection to this program. They are the next obvious thing to try with loop quantum gravity after being done with homogeneous spacetimes. After all, spherical symmetric spacetimes do have a spatial dependence, but there's no dynamics in vacuum, and therefore one sort of expectation one has is it might be like 2 plus 1 gravity, which looked like a field theory, but at the end of the day, it's very simple because there's no local dynamics. We're going to see it doesn't quite work that way. This is work in progress. It's very recent. We were doing calculations up to today, basically. And we don't really have results for the singularity. We have only treated the exterior of the spacetime. So here, technically, the organizers can cancel the talk and we can all go home. But assuming I caught Gary off guard, I'll continue. Now, I always feel funny when dealing with models because there's always a trade-off, of course. If you use a lot of features of the model, it's easy to do. But on the other hand, you don't learn very much about the full theory. On the other hand, if you don't use features, models complicate, and then there's a trade-off, and it's a little bit personal where you stop. You can end up looking like a fool if you're treating a very simple model and you complicate it so much that it's unsolvable. And I can't help but think that in some moments of this talk you'll think that I am a fool, actually. That's a sort of a personal thing, so if someone sort of thinks that, sorry. As you can see, things get unexpectedly complicated, and we advocate that we need to use Novell techniques that are not widely accepted, and I'm really worried that at this point in the audience the string theorists will revolt and leave, basically, because they'll say, look, this was a very simple problem. Suddenly you get into trouble and you come and propose new things that are sort of not widely accepted. Why should we believe you at all? I mean, there ought to be a simpler way to do this. So to try to placate the string theorists at that point, I'll say, okay, fine. If you didn't believe anything of this I said, fine. I'll be fine. Find a way that I can actually do a traditional Dirac treatment of the spherical symmetric case. So nothing strange here. But we'll have to use things that are unlikely to be there for us in the full theory. Okay. So you decide if that's the way you want to do things here. Okay, so let's try to do spherical symmetric gravity and a little bit of history. There's previous work on this going back to the 70s, Beverly Berger, Chitre, Vince Moncrief, Yavuz Nutku, then Fernando Lund, then Bill Enru. All these attempts involved looking at spherical symmetry, not in the simple case I'm looking at here, but actually coupled to scalar fields. People were trying to do a canonical version of the Hawking effect and see how the Hawking radiation comes out. So it's considerably harder than what we're going to attempt here. The sort of definitive work, if you want to do what we're trying to do here, which is just look at vacuum spherically symmetric spacetimes, was due to Karel Kukash in 1994. Now, what Karel did, he didn't proceed naively at all in this example, in spite of the fact that it's so simple. He actually used clever use of symmetry-reduced variables. Essentially, he isolated the embeddings of the spacetime of some variables, and then noted that they drop out from the quantization. You're just left with one variable, which is the mass of the spacetime. Okay, and so the quantization boils down to wave functions of the mass, and there's no dynamics. Okay, which is what you think at the end of the day. This, the content of this theory is there's very little content at all. But again, it doesn't come out easily. I mean, he really goes through a lot of careful choices of canonical variables classically before, at the end of the day, applying the Dirac method and sort of losing everything except this mass at the end of the day. So that one can characterize, as a micro-superspace quantization, because at the end of the day, the only thing left is not even a mechanical, there's one mechanical degree of freedom with no dynamics. So it's really very simple. Now, of course, this is an example of using everything you know about the model to solve. It's very easy to solve, but then there's very little in common with what you expect to see in the full theory, and certainly you can't learn anything about the singularity. The singularity is still there. I mean, this theory in terms of the mass doesn't say anything about it. The space-time sort of rides on top of the theory that is very simple and has the singularity present forever. So that's that. So we would like to try to use less information about the model in question, that is, just impose spherical symmetry and then try to proceed with the usual quantization problem, and we will see that things actually do complicate it. I mean, it's not straightforward if you do things that way. So the problem has to do with the fact that if you don't assume anything about the model, you're dealing now with a MIDI superspace. That is, this is a field theory in principle. Okay, later you'll realize it's not, but at the beginning you do. So say you just write your spatial spherically symmetric metric that everyone knows and loves, and of course you can introduce appropriate canonical momenta and build your canonical theory. And your canonical theory will have the usual constraints that apply in canonical gravity. So you'll have one diffeomorphism constraint left along the radial direction, one Hamiltonian constraint, and that's it. But nevertheless, these diffeomorphisms will close the usual diffeomorphism algebra and have the usual sort of algebra with Hamiltonian. And in particular, the Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonians will be proportional to a diffeomorphism with structure functions here. Now suddenly, when you face this, this is almost as complicated as the full theory, largely because of the presence of this structure function. So this model, as casted, without doing anything special, has this so-called problem of dynamics of canonical quantum gravity. Notice that this is absent in homogeneous cosmologies, because in homogeneous cosmologies, A, you don't have diffeomorphisms to begin with. B, you only have one, not one field theoretic worth of, but one mechanical constraint, or mechanical constraint commutes with itself, and then you have H with H equals zero, and this issue isn't there. So just adding the spatial dependence suddenly brings all these problems to the forefront. And I don't see a way, I mean, unless you want to do something special, that you can avoid that. So let me briefly remind people who haven't thought about this for a while about this problem of dynamics and canonical quantum gravity. And so this is a brief reminder and really is a really oversimplified discussion. I recommend strongly these papers by Thomas, this Insider's View has a good discussion of this. And if you want a shorter discussion, the introduction of the paper with Kristin Giesel recently has a very neat sort of compact discussion of this. Namely, in loop quantum gravity, in addition to the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint, there is this Gauss law because you're using connection variables. And viewed as a quantum constraint, the Gauss law, the basis of solution to Gauss's law is given by these spin network states that we have been talking about all week. And as you've heard, the space is endowed with a natural inner product, and given certain assumptions having to do with the theory's diffeomorphism invariant, it is sort of unique. This is the so-called lost theorem because of Lewandowski, Okowoof, Salman, and Thiemann, who sort of developed it, but it's the way people refer to it.
It was lost for a long time. They should put it to write it up.
Okay. Okay. So essentially, if you want to play this game, you're sort of very constrained in that the space that you can use is given to you. You can't sort of weasel out of it because of the theorem. So in such space, diffeomorphisms are represented by an operator, finite diffeomorphism, but the space is weakly continuous, that is, infinitesimal diffeomorphisms cannot be represented. The space is weakly continuous, so therefore it's not continuous. You can't sort of take the differential. So one doesn't have a representation in the space for the quantum diffeomorphism constraint, which is the generator of infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. Although, of course, one can construct diffeomorphism invariant states and therefore construct the kernel of the constraint. Again, this is very oversimplified the way I'm presenting it, but I'm giving you the gist of the thing so we can do it quickly. So this suggests that one will never be able to find a representation of this portion of the algebra of constraints because one cannot represent this operator. If that is the case, then one is suggesting that one is not going to be able to represent H either. So what is to do? Well, one can find a representation of the Hamiltonian constraint acting on the space of diffeomorphism invariant states, because there, this is zero, and then your H with H will be zero. And this is the gist of the proposal of Thomas in his proposal for the Hamiltonian constraint of 1996, the so-called QSD. Now, yeah.
So this is what happens if you work in the loop variable.
Yeah, if you don't... There are other problems that I haven't mentioned here, namely there are historical problems with this algebra. Like, for instance, if you represent your constraints by self-adjoint operators, you can't get the right-hand side to be self-adjoint and stuff like that. So there are other obstructions as well. Right. Well, you have this problem, you have the other problem as well. So you don't avoid those problems either.
It should be mentioned that, assuming the idea that Steve suggested trying to just count optimization with standard variables and non-local constraints, there are complicated issues about whether you can do self adjoint, but there's some answer to that. I mean, there's some story that all falls to the algebra, which is, it turns out that nothing you perceive, you could look into basically VRST techniques on this kind of thing. Could be followed. The issue there is trying to make these ages in all point operators. I mean, you know, it's kind of a quantum gravity.
Or 1 plus 1 could
have a point. Okay, in the 1 plus 1 case, one might make some progress.
Anyway, so there is this proposal by Thomas acting on this space. And although no one has found anything wrong with this proposal up to now, there is a lot of people that are unhappy about the fact that we are not recovering this quite non-trivial element of the classical algebra of constraints. Basically, having lost this guidance about your theory, there is the worry that the theory you're building will have nothing to do with the classical theory you want to approximate. And you can only answer the question at the very end of the day. That is, if you complete the quantization and then build semi-classical states, then you might verify that you're recovering general relativity. But until you do that, you're completely in the dark. It would have been much nicer if one had a quantization that before you do all that, at least sort of implemented this element of the algebra. Whatever that discussion might be, there is a further problem, that is that some people have looked into trying to do this in spherical symmetry, Martin Boyuwald and Swiderski, and because of technical details of how you construct this operator, when you particularize it to spherical symmetry, you can't get it to commute. Okay? So you can't even do this, or we don't know how to do this in the spherical case. So, hence the problem. Hence the reason that I'm going to try to advocate that we need to use sort of techniques that are not standard here. Okay? So this is sort of the part of the talk that I don't expect a lot of people will be terribly happy, but I'll tell you what my proposal is. Again, I'll redeem myself at the end of this by saying we don't really need this for a spherical case and we can do it the traditional way. Okay, so if you don't believe this, endure the next 10 minutes and we'll be done with it. So several of us then, faced with this other problem, have thought that we need to go to proposals that go beyond the Dirac method. One of them you heard about this week quite a bit is this master constraint proposal of Thomas. The proposal I want to talk about is slightly different, although as you're going to see, there are a lot of points in contact with the master constraint, which is remarkable. The point of view we want to advocate is we would like to define the containment theory as a suitable limit of lattice theories that do not have this problem of the constraint algebra. Okay? But that nevertheless will provide a correspondence principle with a continuum theory, that is, we'll have good checks in the middle of the quantization to see that we're quantizing what we want. And if you want, the gist of what we're trying to do for gravity is what we're lattice QCD did for QCD. Now, there's a problem with this, namely when one discretizes complicated theories with constraints, usually the discrete theories you build differ significantly from the continuum ones. A remarkable observation that most people don't think about it is even if you did just ordinary QCD and you didn't do it in a reasonably smart way, you would face this problem. The reason we don't think about this normally is because people who did lattice QCD were smart. And what they did, for instance, is they chose as variables for the theory, the electric fields, if you do it canonically, the electric fields and the holonomies along the links. These variables are not centered at the same point. They're what is called staggered discretization. That staggered discretization is in part responsible for them being able to preserve Gauss's law. In fact, even for Maxwell theory, if you just discretize in a lattice randomly, you won't preserve Gauss's law. The first person to actually discretize Maxwell's theory, preserving Gauss's law, using a staggered discretization was an engineer in the 1960s called Yi. Okay, so this is fairly non-trivial. Now, people who did lattice QCD, or smart people, did this type of discretization were done. They didn't have any problems. The problem we have is we don't know how to do the same for the constraints of general relativity. We can't choose variables that are going to ensure that the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint will be preserved in evolution when we discretize the theory. Hence the problem.
So I understand by preserved, you mean that there is a discrete version of the Gauss's law, say, which is exactly zero. And
yeah.
It is exactly zero for all time.
Upon evolution. And it's also first class canonically as a constraint. Okay. What usually happens if you don't do clever things is if you take a theory with constraints, you know, even as QCD, if you just do it dumbly, and you discretize the theory, your first class constraints become second class in the discrete theory. Okay. And so the discrete theory has very little in common with the continuum theory. The way you treat second class constraints is completely different from the way you treat first class constraints. Now, what do you do if you actually discretize a theory and you don't know how to fix this, namely you're left with second-class constraints? Well, one possibility is to say, look, the Dirac method knows what to do with second-class constraints, so let's treat them. Okay, so you can handle these theories with a Dirac quantization procedure, but it's very different than what you would do in the continuum. When you handle second-class constraints, the way of doing it is you determine the Lagrange multipliers. So, for instance, if you're doing general relativity, what you find is that the lapse and the shift, which used to be free in your continuum theory, now become determined by the Dirac procedure. We tried to push this point of view for a while over the last few years, namely saying, well, okay, fine, this is our discrete theory, the Dirac method applies, let's use it. But the problem we encountered with this approach that we sort of called consistent discretizations for a while, it was very difficult to get a control of the continuum limit. Namely, the equations that determine the Lagrange multipliers are algebraic equations because everything is discrete, but they're high order, so when you solve them, your Lagrange multipliers might become complex, for instance, and then your theory will be completely useless as an approximation of your continuum theory. And there was no easy way to sort of fix this, so this approach sort of became limited. We pushed this for a while, but it didn't seem to have a lot of promise. So, and you deal with a theory. Yeah. So to tackle this view, this problem, we proposed a new type of discretizations, which we gave it a name called uniform discretizations, and they're defined by the following canonical transformation. So take any variable in your theory, your variable at the instant n plus 1 is given by this expression here, where so that A is any dynamical variable, and H is a quantity, that we can call it a Hamiltonian as you wish, but if it's not, it's simply a function of the constraints of your continuum theory. An example of this function would be the sum of the squares of the constraints of the continuum theory. And here you see parallels developing with this master constraint program. Apart from the fact that we're discrete, this would be Thomas-Neimann's master constraint. How do we know we can do this? Well, basically, when you discretize a theory, you have sufficient leeway in your discretization that you can actually show that you can always make your evolution equations look like this.
Does evolution, again, in some sort of iterative sense, and sort of trying to find, ultimately one just states that are annihilated by H?
Ultimately one wants states that are annihilated. That is, in the continuum theory, H would like it to be zero. The continuum limit H would be zero. In the discrete theory, H is not zero and there is an evolution. Okay. So only in the continuum limit that theory would approximate what you want for ordinary theories.
But you're evolving again in what time?
Suppose you take general relativity, so you do usual canonical treatment, you discretize the constraints, you're going to get evolution equations in terms of your parameter time. So for instance, for the metric and the extrinsic curvature as usual, it would just be discrete equations, and we propose that those discrete equations be given this way.
Is there a classical analog of this?
Continuum, you mean? Continuum.
Oh, classical is not quantum. You're just.
This is still classical.
Okay. So can you check numerically that this works as numerical?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll give you some examples where we have tested it, and there are various people testing it in several GR type situations as well. H is positive definite. In particular, it's nice because we would like to be able to control a continuum limit in which H goes to zero. And so it's sort of nice that it approaches the limit sort of from above. You don't need to take the H that I have here. You can actually use a more general form if you want. But for simplicity in this talk, let's say we're just taking this. So it's like the same as Thomas did in his master constraint program. These discretizations have desirable properties. For instance, H is automatically preserved by this evolution, and therefore the sum squared of the constraints is a constant of the motion. So in particular, if I choose initial data such that H is smaller than a given value, that's going to be preserved. So if I sort of want my constraints to be small initially, they'll be preserved by the evolution to be small. Something that, for instance, these previous discretizations I was talking about don't guarantee at all. Okay. In the next slide. So, as I was saying, if we have initial data such as H is small, then the constraints remain bounded throughout the evolution, and you can control a continuum limit of the theory by choosing initial data. Let me show what Ted wanted, namely that in the continuum limit we get the evolution equations we want. So I'll take some initial data with some value for H that I'll call delta squared, define these quantities lambda, which are the constraints, the value of the constraints divided by this delta. And then the evolution equations that I had in the previous slides in the continuum limit take this form. That is, the leading contribution is given by this Poisson bracket of the constraints with the variable in question times this quantity lambda plus sort of contributions that go as the spacing squared. So in the continuum limit, one could define the time derivative to be this, and then one is left with this contribution, which is the ordinary sort of evolution equation, with these lambda being the ordinary Lagrange multipliers. The Lagrange multipliers are determined by this theory, just like we said before. So they're the values of the constraints initially that you chose in your initial data, but apart from that, the evolution equations reproduce those of the theory you wanted. So this is what you were asking?
What if I exactly satisfy the constraints?
If you exactly satisfy the constraints initially, then there's no evolution. So you need to be off the constraint service for this evolution to work and for the limit to exist. That's the whole reason to go discrete. You might ask, why don't you do this in the continuum? In the continuum, you can't. I mean, this H that we have is not a good Hamiltonian because it's quadratic in the constraints. So it vanishes on the constraint surface. It's off the constraint surface that it can generate a genuine evolution. Schematically, what Ted was asking is this. Namely, say this is your sort of discrete theory and your constraint surface of the discrete theory. Our evolution takes place off the constraint surface in the discrete theory, but as we make the discretization sort of better, we get closer to the constraint surface. Or so is the hope. I mean, we'll see that, I mean, for mechanical systems and so on, this can be done always. It gets a little bit more complicated the more complicated the theory you look at. In complete generality, of course, I can't answer that question. I can show you several models, and I'll mention them in a second, where it works. Some models where it doesn't work, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, when I show you that. In particular, one can easily show that the constants of the motion of your discrete theory become, in the continuum limit, the observables, or perennials, the quantities that don't evolve in the continuum theory. And conversely, for each perennial in the continuum theory, one has a counterpart in this discrete theory. So essentially what we're saying is we recover everything you want of the theory, the equations of motion in terms of the parameter time, the constraints of the theory, exactly in the continuum limit, and the observables, namely the perennials, as functions of phase space. And that's everything you can expect to get in a constraint theory. There's a caveat that I went a little bit fast in the previous slide. I mean, there's only limited time to show these things. And what I was assuming there is that the constraints are first class. If the constraints are second class, and this is a problem, as I said, we need to face, the same proofs that we had there goes through, but instead of having the usual Poisson bracket in the evolution equation, one has to use the Dirac brackets. And this, as I said, is important in the case of field theories, because there, when you discretize space and time, the constraints generically are second class. Now, you might be worried about this, because you might say, well, but if you now you have to use Dirac brackets, then you're back to sort of a complicated sort of treatment like you had before. So there's essentially three things you can do with this, okay? And I'll advocate one, but you can choose whatever you want. Either you work with Dirac brackets, and this if you're thinking of GR in three dimensions, this is going to be very challenging. And it's not something you're going to make a lot of progress with, but at least in models you could try it. You could work with ordinary Poisson brackets in the equations, but take the spatial continuum limit first, unless you do a really dumb discretization. If you, normally, when you take the spatial continuum limits, the constraints become first class again. Not necessarily, but you can usually arrange that. So the discrete constraints, so you discretize space and time. If I now take the spatial continuum limit, usually the constraints become first class, and then everything I said in the previous slide goes through. Now, that might be unnatural in the context of gravity to take the spatial continuum limit first, but you could do that. Something else you could do is forget all this, treat everything as if you were dealing with Poisson brackets, and hope that everything arranges itself in the continuum limit. Because in the continuum limit, the constraints become first class. So presumably, things might work. So, might is the important word there. I mean, this is not guaranteed to work. It's complete generality. So, the question many of you will have at this point is, well, have you tried this and anything else but gravity to try to see if this works? I mean, this looks sort of far out. Before that, let me show you how you deal with quantization of these theories. Notice that the one, you might hate these discrete theories for a variety of reasons, but one good thing they have is they have no first-class constraints anymore. So all the usual hard issues of canonical quantum gravity are gone. Okay, you're essentially quantizing a mechanical system with no constraints.
Sorry, you said they usually have second-class constraints.
Yeah. Right. So I told you what we're going to do with the second class constraints in the previous slides. You can do each of those three things. One of them is just ignore them. Okay. And then the theory you have has no constraints at all. So you have no problem of time, no issue of observables. You can set up relational things, do the Page-Waters quantization, whatever you want. There's no issue there. So they're nice from that point of view. So essentially, to quantize these theories, you write the evolution equations. And what you do is implement them via a unitary operator. Remember, picture in mind that what you're just doing is ordinary quantum mechanics. Everything is discrete, so there's a finite number of degrees of freedom. There's no constraints anymore. So you can definitely attempt to implement your classical evolution equations through a unitary operator. In particular, what this is nice is that it will recover the classical evolution equation up to factor ordering issues, and therefore you have a correspondence principle with a classical discrete theory. So in the middle of the quantization, you can check that you're actually recovering the equations you want without having to go to the continuum limit at the end of the day. So in the case of gravity, that's going to be nice. This is what's going to sort of play the role of that missing element of the algebra constraints. It will provide a check that the quantum theory you're building makes some sort of sense. You can use this method to actually find a projector in the space of physical states. So in that sense, it resembles the group averaging procedure. Namely, what you want is this unitary operator to correspond to H equals zero. So the unitary operator acting on your state is just identity. And therefore, the physical states of your theory are just defined via an operation like this one. In particular, you can write an explicit projector to do this. And this limit of this unitary operator, if you choose these coefficients in a given way, this projector will project you on this face, on the space of physical states of the continuum theory you want. So it's like the Dirac procedure plus the group averaging procedure. It provides a projector on the face of physical states. So the question was, well, have you tried this in models and see if this works? So we have tried several examples up to now, and we need to thank for this to Bianca Dietrich and Thomas Thiemann, because they went through all these examples with the master constraint program. And since essentially we are computing something very similar to them, we can steal pages and pages of their papers and go through these examples really quickly. So that's what allowed us to sort of do this. So in particular, we were able to show that if you have abelian constraints, this method is entirely equivalent to the Dirac quantization procedure. And this is sort of nice because, for instance, if you take 2 plus 1 gravity, formulated like these people did, the constraints are abelian, and then you can apply this method to 2 plus 1 gravity and get the usual sort of Witten quantization without any problems because it's completely equivalent to the Dirac quantization.
Sorry,
yeah.
Is the issue of the continuum limit?
Yeah.
Is that something we're going to talk about, or is that something one has to check here?
One has to check. So, for instance, for these models, the continuum limit exists, and it agrees with the Dirac quantization procedure. For these models, namely a finite number of non-abelian constraints that form an algebra, so for instance, take a mechanical system and take the generators of SU2 equals to zero, then again, you can prove that you get the continuum limit and you reproduce the standard direct quantization procedure and the group averaging approach to get the states for this model.
And
these types of models, the discretized constraints are first class, because the constraints that become second class are the ones in field theories where the spatial dependencies sort of screws up things. When you have mechanical systems like these, the constraints remain first class. So abelian constraints, it works. For this simple example of non-abelian constraints, it works. Let's go to a more challenging model, namely a mechanical system, but now where the constraints are now SO2-1 instead of SU2. This example is known to be problematic for everyone. So for instance, for the group averaging procedure, Don and Andy Gomberoff studied this. And what they showed is that the group averaging procedure literally doesn't work in this case. You need to extend it by adding states by hand to deal with this model. The master constraint in its original version also fails here. Namely, the master constraint is such that as a quantum operator doesn't have zero in its kernel. So this was the first indication, I think, that one might need a more extended proposal than the original one in which one subtracts the lowest eigenvalue of the master constraint. Okay? What happens to us? Well, because the H, this quantity, is akin to the master constraint, it also doesn't have zero in its kernel, and therefore the theory doesn't have a continuum limit. So the quantum theories we build, one cannot take the continuum limit because H going to zero, which is the continuum limit, is not in the kernel of the H operator. So then what do you do? Well, you could say the method failed, and that's it. Or you could try to do what everyone else does and say, well, could this method describe this model somehow? And as I said, this problem parallels sort of problems that everyone else has here. So what this suggests is the following point of view. Namely, yes, you're not going to be able to take the continuum limit in your quantum theory. So you'll have to live with a discrete quantum theory for the model. And you can only expect the quantum theory to approximate the continuum theory for certain states. And you can check this, that actually you can do these calculations, namely that for certain states of the discrete theory, you approximate the continuum theory reasonably well, but for certain states you don't. So this is the point of view that we want to take, namely the continuum limit is an achievable goal in the classical limit for some states, but in the full quantum theory, one cannot take the continuum limit, and one will have to live with a discrete theory.
Yeah. I want to say that this is a technical problem requiring kind of realization, and there was a lot of time in the theory. It's not a new theory, this one is not well applied.
Right, right.
But you are saying that you get a different result.
What I'm saying is that well-defined continuum theory can be approximated by my method, but I cannot get it as a limit, as an exact limit of the method. No, just well, the classical continuum theory we're talking about here. So you can approximate classical continuum states. It's easier to think of it in the context of gravity. I mean, classical GR, you wouldn't expect classical states that have small variations of Planck length size to be approximated by any theory. And this model is the same story. If you sort of build classical states that have certain rapid variations, you can't approximate it with a theory you want. But that's sort of, a lot of people consider that reasonable in the context of gravity.
But again, it's quantum theory, it's just different
theory. We don't get it, basically. Yeah. Notice that this idea of remaining off the continuum limit at a quantum level has been mentioned by several other people, in particular John Clouder, several years ago, and I think this inspired Thomas also to mention that in the master constraint, you might not want the master constraint to be zero.
But when Don says something is renormalized, isn't that just like what Clouder suggested that
It is different what Don does, yeah. You look at it, but they have to essentially add some states. You add one state, actually.
It's just like what we did in the Google spin networks. You sort of look at the loop after loop, and you can just as a way to extract down a sort of overall infinite coefficient, and you do some super selection sectors, and then there's there are finite inner products. That means well.
Yeah.
So is that a kind of global order for that system, or more complicated than that?
No, it's not. It's more or less just, you've got some. The divergence because you're trying to sum over a non-compact group. It's a more slightly, it's a system, it's a, if you look at the system realize in this case, you can sort of pull out a factor of all the way into it and drop it. It's completely deriving various speech mixing schemes for path intervention or something.
It seems to me that you would be able to get something like what Bob was saying. But it's sort of tricky because you're sort of
right, so my statement is the original method as applied failed, and then you're going to do various things. And we could discuss how much you want to invest in solving that now. Yeah.
You seem to be sort of equating taking a continuum limit and having h go to zero. Is that right?
Reasonably, yes.
I don't understand. Having h goes to zero just means.
I'm sorry, h goes big H, you mean?
Big H, yeah.
Yes.
But if the constraints are zero, that just means you're sort of classically, you're along the classical constraint surface.
Right, but in my evolution equation, I'm also taking a very small step because H was my evolution operator. So if H goes to zero, the step is small.
But your spatial discretization is also somehow tied to that?
No.
Okay. So you're not taking continuum limit in space when H goes to zero.
I have the option of doing it.
You have to do that by hand.
By hand, yeah.
Is there a way of checking whether you have something with Lorentz invariance
The closest in these models you can get is this, namely, it won't be Lorentz invariance, but say is the state SO21 invariance. And this, the answer is it's approximately SO21 invariance.
You recover that in the limit.
You recover that in the limit, yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Classically, we can work on the constraint surface and have lots of non-trivial evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And as Thomas was saying, since H is the square of the constraints,
yes.
Right, the first Poisson bracket doesn't do anything. So
yeah.
No evolution should get two Poisson brackets.
Mm-hmm.
So, why? Are you getting sort of ordinary classical
evolution? Yeah, I showed you that the ordinary classical evolution equations, Q with phi, not Q with H, is Q dot come out as a limit of this thing. So
this you get that
yeah.
You do have to take an infinite number of steps in that limit to get a finite distance and time of evolution.
Yeah.
And then there's the question of whether instabilities, when you do finite differencing of equations, the more steps you take, the more your errors can accumulate.
Yeah. In general, I cannot make a statement about that, sir.
But in these models, it changes the
equation. In these models, it doesn't happen.
But if you place it, but it doesn't make any more, it
doesn't
happen.
Yeah. You don't get the continuum limit, yeah. All right, so this was the lowest point of the talk, I think, where I think most people were saying, well, this is all very strange and new and so on. Let me go back to spherical symmetry, and let me not use these techniques we just mentioned. Let's just try to do a traditional direct quantization, except I'll have to use things that only happen in spherical symmetry. Okay, so I'm going to use the new variables because we want to do loop representations, and this has been looked at by some people in the past, Bengtson early on, and then more recently Martin Boyewald and Swiderski looked at this. And basically what you do is you choose connections and try as they're adapted to the spherical symmetry. And this is the explicit form if you want to see them. This had been considered in the past also by people who looked at spherical symmetry, Yang-Mills theory. So this is reasonably well known. Turns out that things simplify if you sort of, the x is the direction that we're, the radial direction we're looking at. And the transverse directions, if you sort of bundle the connection into sort of angular variables, things simplify a little bit. And then
what sine of d by d theta?
What sine of d by d theta?
Sine of theta d by dx and sine.
Oh, this is wrong. Sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. This is just the usual sort of basis in spherical symmetry. I'm missing something here. Yeah, I apologize for that. Martin and Swiderski also looked at some issues having to do with fall-off conditions of this, because if you want to discuss sort of like a Schwarzschild geometry, things have to fall off appropriately. And it turns out further changes of variables are suggested by them. And so one is left with a theory with the following canonical pairs. There's a connection and a triad in the sort of radial direction, and then a sort of connection and a triad in the sort of angular direction, and these other two canonical variables there. The constraints for these variables are known. I mean, so one has a Gauss law, or what's left of Gauss's law is an abelian constraint that is here. There's just one diffeomorphism constraint left, and there's a Hamiltonian constraint left, and they have this form here. To simplify matters further, I'm going to fix the spatial coordinate gauge. This will get rid of the diffeomorphism constraint. Now, this is something that one could envision doing in the full theory. I mean, Abai has been pointing out that we should fix gauges, so it's you don't need to do this, by the way. I mean, it just simplifies calculations. You can actually treat the model without doing this, but it simplifies things. This eliminates the diffeomorphism constraint. It still leaves your Gauss law, so you can still do a loop representation, and a Hamiltonian constraint. And the Hamiltonian constraint now has a first-class algebra, but again, it has structure functions. So it's still a challenging problem. So this constraint is gone, but as we're going to see, the algebra of H with H still has structure functions, so this is not an easy thing to deal with. The gauge choice I want to make is to take that triad and along the x direction be a constant, which is one half of the mass at the horizon. And this sets the horizon at the coordinate value x equals 0. Essentially, what this gives you is isotropic Schwarzschild coordinates. One solves the diffeomorphism constraint for Ax, and substituting in H, one has an equation for just this canonical pair. So the only canonical pair left is this E phi, E phi. And the Hamiltonian constraint takes this form. And the constraint algebra, as I was saying, there's still a Gauss law. It's an abelian Gauss law now. Gauss with Hamiltonian is now zero. But H with H still has structure functions in it. So this problem, this model, notice we went to spherical symmetry. We now gauge fix the diffeos, and still, we still have a problem of the dynamics here. Okay, so this is not easy to treat. So we could use this method I described before, but again, I didn't want to belabor you with it at this moment. So what we'll do is we'll use a trick here, and a trick that I think is unlikely to work in the full theory. It turns out for this example, if you divide this constraint by E phi, the constraint becomes abelian. And actually, we will see that one can immediately discretize it, and it remains abelian upon discretization. This is what you don't expect to have in the full theory. But then, with abelian constraints, we can apply the sort of traditional Dirac methods. And that's what we're going to do. But we want to do this in the loop representation, so let me talk a little bit about how one builds a loop representation in the context of spherical symmetry. So basically, the only manifold now is a line, is the radial line, and what's left of a graph that you have in these spin networks is just a bunch of edges along this line. So your graph is going to be a union of these edges. There's only one variable left that behaves like a connection, which is this radial portion of the connection. So for that variable, you could really build usual loops along this real line and build loop variables. The other variables in the problem, this eta and a phi, are actually scalars. So you could build a sort of akin to a loop representation for them, but it's going to be one of the, using these sort of called point holonomies, like people, for instance, who do loop quantum cosmology use. Namely, you exponentiate the variable with a parameter in front of it, pretending it's a holonomy, but it's not a holonomy because there's nothing transverse to integrate upon. So to avoid presenting too many equations, what I'll do is I'll write the loop representation in the sort of gauge fix case we introduced. I mean, one can introduce it also for the full case. So in this case, actually, AX is not present anymore. So the only holonomies one is left with are these sort of fake ones, the point holonomies, for the variables A phi. So the only canonical pair left is A phi and E phi, and this A phi sometimes is related to the extrinsic curvature, K phi, where this is the Mirzi parameter. Sometimes we'll write things in terms of K for some reason. So I just mentioned that there. The Hilbert space is n copies, if you have n points in your sort of spatial line, of the same Hilbert space that is used in loop quantum cosmology with the Bohr compactification because of the use of these point holonomies. A spin network state would be something like this. These are the point holonomies, namely it's the exponentiation of the variable you want. times a parameter, mu, times the emergency parameter, if you're using the emergency parameter. The triad quantum operators have a well-defined action on the states as usual. So this is the action of the quantum triads on the basis of states we're using. The volume of an interval now, of I along the radial line, can be written as a well-defined operator. Classically, it's this expression here. Quantum mechanically, this can be promoted to an operator. So just like in the full theory, the volume operator is well-defined. One can introduce a basis, actually, of loop states, just in this way. And this Bohr measure that we have guarantees a sort of usual inner product, namely if the graph agrees, you have one. If not, you get zero. So this is sort of very similar to the full theory. As in the full theory, these holonomies are well-defined operators in the loop representation. Okay, so just as in the full theory, one will have to write the constraints in terms of holonomies and triads because they are the things that are well-defined. Here we have the challenge that that Hamiltonian constraint we have, we'll have to write it in terms of the holonomy because this is the operator that is well-defined in the loop representation.
Yeah. But at this stage, you have to expose the two models and gauge freedom. Therefore, there's only Hamiltonian constraint.
Gauge freedom hasn't been fixed. The gauge freedom is handled in the usual way through the holonomies, right? Yes, so they're scalars, basically. Yeah.
Right.
And the Gauss law was abelian to begin with, so it's very simple.
Then, and are you looking at the whole real line? Or are you
we're looking at a chunk of the real line, so R plus, if you want, and finite, actually.
And are there some boundary conditions?
Yeah, so the boundary condition at the horizon I told you already is equivalent to an isolated horizon boundary condition, actually, and it just fixes the spatial coordinate to be isotropic coordinates. It's very simple. One more thing, one can do this sort of theme and trick that you heard about this morning. I omit the calculation. This is the analog here of that. So in particular, the inverse triad is a bounded operator in this representation. So this hints at possibility of eliminating the singularity. But again, I mean, I'm only looking at the exterior, so this is just a hint. But it's sort of nice that this thing works out in detail. We are now ready then to represent this abelian Hamiltonian constraint that we had in the loop representation. We write it in terms of quantities, again, that are easy to represent in the loop representation. Namely, we don't use connections. We use little pieces of holonomies. This is what it said here. And this was a classical constraint one wants to represent. It's the one that is abelian, has been divided by A phi. And this is the sort of discrete constraint that we want to represent in the loop representation. And again, here's where you see the holonomies have been brought to play, namely this quantity sine squared a rho divided by rho squared. In the limit rho going to 0 would just give the connection that you have up here. But if you keep things finite, this is, you know, portion of a holonomy, so it's easy to represent in the sort of loop representation. Interestingly enough, if you stare at this for a while, you'll notice that this constraint is the sum of a term at the position m, and the sum of the term at the position m minus 1. So automatically, this is abelian. So this discrete version of the constraint is abelian. And this is sort of rather non-trivial and unexpected to happen in the full theory. It just happens for this model.
What are the guarantees that he
himself? Because it's a function at a point that commutes with itself, plus a function of another point that commutes with itself, and they commute with each other because the variables at two different points in the lattice commute with each other. Yeah. It turns out that actually one can solve this constraint quantum mechanically in the connection representation. What you do is you rewrite it this way. This way guarantees that each of the two terms vanishes individually. The reason for that is, of course, this connects m with m minus 1. So you have to start at one boundary and then start sort of solving this way. And because of the boundary conditions chosen, one of the terms actually vanishes at the boundary. So you have to solve one of them at the next point. And then that sort of concatenates and you essentially impose that each of these terms vanish individually. So this is the classical solution of the constraint. Quantum mechanically, you can promote this to an operator and find the solution for it. And the solution are states of this form. They depend on the only variable left, k. The variable a, which was the value of the mass. I didn't discuss entirely what happens at the boundary, but at the boundary, one has a little theory where there's the mass and its canonically conjugate variable, and a time variable at the boundary, and its canonically conjugate momentum, and that's the variable is tau. And so this equation, this is a quantum operator equation, has these states as exact solutions, and these functions f are completely determined. It can be written in terms of elliptic integrals and so on. I don't have it on the slide because there's no point of it. But the bottom line is this chunk of the function is given for just one. It's fixed. And the only thing left is what Kukash had, namely a function of the mass. And the proper time at infinity, but there's a constraint at infinity you need to impose. And the constraint is such that the functions actually are only functions of the mass. So surprisingly, we have recovered Kukash's quantization. That is, the whole discreteness and loops and everything is sort of sitting on top of this extremely simple quantum theory with states that are functions of the mass, and there is no evolution for it.
The mass is a continuous parameter.
The mass is a continuous parameter.
You're taking the continuum limit.
You could take the continuum limit because everything is sitting on top of this and there's nothing non-trivial happening. So it's a sort of trivial continuum limit if you want. That is, this is true even for the discrete theory that this is the state. But the point is, all this stuff is essentially going along for the ride and it's not playing a dynamic role. So the continuum limit is sort of trivial.
Does that thing which is going for the ride, does that know anything in the continuum limit about the discretization being used or anything
else? How unique is the procedure? Yeah, so this is one of these issues that we discussed at length. How unique are you know, the way of doing lattice gauge theory without a randomization group are unique. Well, for this particular model, unless you're very perverse, this discretization is more or less the only thing you can do because the functions are very simple. I mean, you could think of doing weirder things when you discretize derivatives and so on, but it will always involve functions at different points on the lattice, and my suspicion is the quantization will be pretty much the same. I don't want to make a strong claim of this. The model is so simple, the fact that you have some level of uniqueness is perhaps an accident, okay? But you could, for instance, at each of these functions of m and m minus 1, you could add a function to it that is times epsilon and that goes to 0 in the limit. Well, that's not going to change this at all in the limit. So it is reasonably unique. Again, I mean, uniqueness is an issue of how perverse you want to be about it. So essentially, one is left with a function of the mass and the wave function of the theory, and there's no dynamics. Now, I said I was going to do things in the loop representation, but suddenly I presented for you the solution in the connection representation. Well, it turns out you can do things in the loop representation as well. There's no problem with that. It turns out this version of the constraint, which is equivalent to this, is better to promote. And if you promote it to an operator in the loop representation, you get this constraint here. And if you squint your eyes and you look at this function at m plus 4, m minus 4, it sort of is very reminiscent of what, you know, people in the loop quantum cosmology case got. So this sort of hints that maybe resolution of singularities and so on could go more or less the same way. But again, we're only treating the exterior, so all those are wishes. Turns out you can solve this recursion regression if you want. I'm not going to give you a solution because it's sort of messy. And it's also true. Okay, so this is what I just said. There's contact with the loop quantum cosmology case. It suggests that maybe there's a similar resolution for the Schwarzschild singularity as the cosmological one, but again, we don't know about that. Our coordinates are not good for discussing that. And the interesting thing is that you can actually write the loop transform between these two representations. Take the solution that you found for this, transform it, and it actually gives a solution in the connection representation. You can do this explicitly, entirely for this model. Okay, so I'm about to finish. So I didn't use this method I mentioned, so you might ask, well, suppose you hadn't done this trick. Suppose you had the Hamiltonian that had structure functions and you wanted to use your method, what would have happened? Okay, so one last slide on this and I'll let you go. Namely, suppose we hadn't done that trick that made the constraint abelian and we had to deal with the fact that we had structure functions. Could we have used this method? Well, it turns out you can actually go ahead and write this H operator that we had. And it expects some of the challenges that one expects in the full theory. First of all, there is significant ambiguity. First of all, one constructs the evolution operator, which is the exponential of the square of the constraints. And what one would have to do is promote that operator to a quantum operator and solve it. Find eigenstates and see if among those eigenstates, zero is an eigenvalue, and then you can take the continuum limit. Now that sounds and is challenging. First of all, there is ambiguity when you discretize. Secondly, although it's a simple problem, it is a quantum mechanical problem. It is a complicated quantum mechanical problem. It's sort of akin to a solid state model. It's not easy to solve. It's not easy to find the eigenstates of this operator. So we haven't done that, for instance. And what one can do, however, is make some estimates. Namely, you can take the operator you build, I'm skipping all the details here, but you can take the operator and stick in the states that we found in the exact quantization we did. Now, those aren't going to be eigenstates of your model, but at least it'll give you an estimate, lower bound, or an upper bound, actually, on the eigenvalues that you can get for this operator. So if you actually do this calculation explicitly, what you get are contributions of this form. Okay, and you can play around with your discretization ambiguity to try to make some of these terms disappear. But generically, what we have seen is that you might be able to take the classical limit of this, so L Planck goes to zero, but generically, you won't be able to take the continuum limit of the quantum theory. That is, if I'm the quantum theory and I just take the continuum limit, this doesn't exist. Now, I cannot prove to you that making use of the ambiguity, one cannot fix this. Generically, that's not there.
But it doesn't exist means just that you can't find zero in the spectrum of Hamiltonian, or means something else?
It means this, namely, if I try to take the continuum limit, the minimum eigenvalue that I get behaves this way,
and
right. So I can take the sort of classical continuum limit that exists, but I cannot take the continuum limit within the quantum theory. So this is very similar to what happened in that SO2-1 model. I think it's the general belief of people that is what one is going to get in the full theory. Okay. Now, perhaps for this model, one that could be fixed, but one gets the generic behavior one expects in the full theory. So this doesn't have a quantum continuum limit, but it has a classical continuum limit, and that's the reason I advocated that this is probably what one will have to live with in the full theory. Solving the problem becomes a hard problem in quantum mechanics. That is, you have to take this operator and actually find the eigenstates and eigenvalues, and we haven't done that yet. It is akin to solid-state physics. It's a problem in quantum mechanics, but it's a hard one. It's not easy to do. And you'll have to tackle it via some method, either using variational methods, perturbative methods, or numerical methods. And you might again think that I'm a fool. Spherically symmetric gravity, you're going to do numerical calculations for that. But again, the point is we're trying to do it the hardest possible way to resemble the full theory. And I think everyone would agree that in the full theory, if you're in full DGR, you're not going to be able to do things exactly right. So one shouldn't be scared of this. It's sort of not terribly encouraging, but on the other hand, it's sort of reality, right? One last observation, and then I quit. Since we cannot take the quantum continuum limit, we can ask what is the minimum eigenvalue of H, and again, we can estimate that using the states that we already had, which are not exact eigenstates of this thing, but we take the expectation value and see what we get, and one gets this result that epsilon, the minimum value, okay, so we don't have a continuum limit anymore. Epsilon going to zero is not an option. There's a value of epsilon at which this H becomes minimum, so we're closer to the continuum theory than for any other value. The value for which that happens is given by L Planck squared times A, where A was the mass of this spacetime. So if you're looking at a Schwarzschild black hole, this theory would have the minimum eigenvalue at a discretization parameter that is sort of 10 to the minus 80. So the eigenvalue of H is 10 to the minus 80, so it would be a presumably very good approximation to the continuum theory. The last observation I want to make is sort of an intriguing thing that sort of comes out of a loop quantization without any use of these fancy techniques, and it's an observation, if you want. There's nothing profound we can show at the moment. And as we said, as in loop quantum cosmology, one expects, well, first of all, there is this parameter, rho, that I think you call it mu or something else, and the V in the loop quantum cosmology cases is what would play the role of the length of the harmony, except that we're looking at a direction where there's no length, right? In the loop, in the homogeneous case, everything is homogeneous. Here, it's sort of one of these variables that are just scalar fields. So if one assumes that that parameter takes a finite minimum value, guided by the values given by the minimum of the area in the full theory, just like they do in loop quantum cosmology, If you act with this holonomy on a spin network state, you notice that the state before and after is an eigenstate of the volume, and the volume changes this amount. And then the interesting observation is that if I consider a shell of width delta x, I will find n elements of volume delta v within the shell given by this number. And therefore, if the shell is finite, one gets that the number of elementary excitations given by, you know, adding elements of volume by adding these point holonomies goes actually as the sort of radius of the shell squared, which is, you know, suggestive of a Bekenstein bound. So it somehow suggests that in this loop, I mean, again, this is a pure kinematics statement. You gotta forget the rest of the talk and just look at the piece where I set up the loop representation. And it's sort of intriguing that this happened. I mean, if you had asked me before starting this, anything related to the Bekenstein bound, which is something that string theory seemed to like, I would have said, no, of course not. There's nothing here to do that. And yet, the way the volume operator sort of works seems to suggest this. Anyway, let me conclude. So one can study spherically symmetric gravity using loop quantum gravity. You either need to use special features of spherical symmetry if you want to apply the traditional direct quantization technique. The setup is ready. We need to extend it to horizon-penetrating coordinates, and then we could start finally making some contact with the program and making statements about the singularity. So everything I discussed was on the exterior, but as you saw, we're completely set up to now looking in the interior just by using appropriate coordinates. Without using special tricks that only happen to work for, or are likely to work in the general theory, the problem is hard. Now, it offers a promising arena to test new ideas, like this uniform discretization approach that I advocated, or the master constraint program of Thomas. Thank you.
So this minimum epsilon that you computed at the end, that's exactly the radius at which the curvature of the Schwarzschild black hole becomes the Planck scale.
Okay.
Is that a coincidence, or is that, the curvature is m over r cubed, so if that's one of those Planck squares, you get exactly.
I haven't thought about that, so it might be a coincidence, or simply I don't know.
The whole thing is outside the horizon.
So yeah. No. And again, it's an estimate for the bound. We haven't solved this h psi equal c times psi exactly. So this is just using the states of the that we computed exactly for the abelian model, sticking them in there and seeing what we get as a value. So it's a little bit. I mean, it might be that the correct minimum is lower than this. This is just to get an idea of the number, basically.
Have you thought of trying this method on a relativistic string?
Relativistic string. So it's a 1 plus 1 dimensional model.
Does a 1 plus 1 get you in various simple constraints?
Are they really simple?
Well, relatively
simple. If it doesn't have a structure function problem, then it's simpler. I'm sure Thomas will formulate it for you with a structure function algebra if he wants to.
I think there are no other structure functions. They're almost trivial, but basically in the real zero algebra,
they're independent of phase space.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Now, notice that this model I was looking at had no degrees of freedom, and I ran into all this trouble. So in this model, you do have degrees of freedom, right? So it might be simpler for other reasons, but it won't be easy either, I think.
Wait, I'm a little puzzled on how what you conclude from that. Does that mean you're not going to try that anymore?
Oh, yeah, I'll keep on trying, but I want to finish this first. I'm just saying it's not cheap to do any of these things. Even to solve this model entirely, that is to take this H and find its eigenstates and see the minimum value, is going to be a challenging sort of quantum mechanical calculation akin to solving some problem in solid state physics or statistical mechanics, I mean, where you have to diagonalize a Hamiltonian that is complicated.
But this is the case where we basically.
Okay.
Right? It's string theory. It's basically string.
Okay, we can try that, certainly. I mean, again, it's not, I expect the level of complexity is similar to this. So, unless one uses special things.
So you got this exact solution. So you got the sort of Prukash free factor, and then there's some sort of complicated thing that solves all your constraints. Is there some sense in which that looks like Schwarzschild?
The rest.
I mean,
the rest is exactly Schwarzschild, yeah.
Does it involve elliptic intervals and stuff?
No, that's the wave function, right?
Yeah. The wave function.
Right, but if I take the E's, for instance, the triads, and evaluate them, the E's that I get are the triads of ordinary Schwarzschild in sort of isotropic coordinates. So the wave functions are complicated, but the E's take eigenvalues that are very...
Expectation values,
yeah.
Maybe it's complicated to say.
Yeah. I mean, recall that elliptic thing is just a phase, right? It's an exponential of I times that. So that plays no role when you take expectation values.
Comment on the relation between your proposals, especially when you extend to horizon penetrating coordinates, and what?
No, because I haven't done it.
And although you've been pursuing it, it looks quite similar in some respects.
I'm quite reluctant to make comments about how this works in the horizon penetrating case because we haven't done it. You have to set up the coordinates. I mean, when you look at.
But I mean, just even the starting point. What is different about?
Okay, so what Hussein and Winkler did was for various models, cosmology, spherical, etc., implement on the traditional variables a quantization that is sort of akin to this. So just like when we have a scalar field, we pretend we have a holonomy associated with it, although there is no connection involved. One can do the same thing with the traditional variables, at least in simple models, and that's what they have done. So in that sense, it's very similar. The thing that a lot of people would say about their work is that, well, they don't have a full framework where they could apply similar ideas and where this could be derived from. What you will tell me is, well, maybe you can find such a framework and we haven't found it yet. Okay, so he agrees with that. So
I also didn't understand what the conclusion was. And you say this model is interesting because you have a special general theory about your uniform visualization method. It sure sounds like you're saying it doesn't work.
No, what I'm saying is it's hard.
Well, when you say it doesn't have to do with a limit, you don't think of that.
Okay, so
the minimum epsilon.
Right.
Well, the minimum epsilon is state dependent. There's not a theory of the minimum epsilon.
I'm sorry? No. There is a minimum epsilon. If I were able to solve that H operator and find the minimum eigenvalue, that would be the minimum epsilon. The reason it's state dependent is I don't know. I haven't done that calculation, so I just stuck in a state and computed a value, just to get a ballpark figure of the value. But actually, it's a minimum eigenvalue of the epsilon, so that would be well defined.
Okay, I still believe that if you're in a coherent plane near some classical value of the mass, that your H operator might still have some minimal scale. It depends on which state you're.
The H will have a minimum value that I don't expect to be zero, if that's what you were getting at.
H squared or beta tend on the same. Fluctuations in H may depend on...
The fluctuations in H would depend on the state, yeah.
So,
now, on the other hand, if you just wanted me to get a continuum limit, I can take my method, apply it to this abelian algebra, and it goes through, there's a continuum limit and everything, but that's not interesting, right? Yeah.
So if you don't reproduce that exactly, what does that count?
That in the case of interest, it might not be a quantization of the continuum theory, and the best thing we can come up with is this. So if in those models I can approximate the continuum quantization that exists, we feel more or less confident that this is not a completely ridiculous procedure in the case where there might not be a continuum quantization.
So let's put it this way. If you're not trying to reduce a continuum quantization, and you use a continuum quantization, procedures may have problems of trying to reproduce some classical constraint algebra and so forth. What is the corresponding consistency check you want to do for a uniform discretization approach to see if it is reproducing the right physics?
The evolution equations are the ones I want, right? So that my discrete evolution has the classical limit of those quantum equations that I have, give the sort of classical evolution equations for the discrete theory.
I mean, it's sort of like a Gramming there's no consistency check you can see short of really solving the quantum evolution dynamics and comparing it to classical dynamics and some semi classical.
Right. Right. That is a semi-classical image. You just want the quantum evolution equations up to factor ordering to be operator versions of your classical equations. That's all you want.
You like the classical to be correct. It's not obvious that it's
right.
GR.
Right. That definitely is what you want to do. This other thing doesn't guarantee it, but it's something that has to happen in the way if you want to guarantee that at the end of the day.
What was the other thing?
Well, you have a classical limit, et cetera, right? I mean, just guaranteeing that, that your classical equations are implemented as operator quantum operator equations is guaranteeing anything. Yeah.